You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
95. All right, Connor, all yours, mate.
Awesome. So, yeah, talking about Singapore, like I said, about the summit, we're going to talk a little bit more in Singapore. So, yeah, I'm going to fire off a few quick little bits of trivia about the country just to get you kind of introduced. So, Singapore is a tiny island, so tiny that to get from one side of the island to the other is about the same distance as driving from here to Kumeu. To get from the top of the island to the bottom of the island is about from here to Albany. So, it takes about 50 minutes to drive from one side of the country to the other.
But the population is about
5 million people.
Right.
Crammed onto an island that size.
And you actually used to be one of those 5 million.
I did from 2005 to 2010. So this is a bit of a personal story. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the a little bit about what Singapore's all about the political state, because they've had the same party in power since independence in 1965 from Britain. And it's going to give you a little bit of a backstory, because most people go and visit and they experience the nice stuff like the shopping and all of that, but I'm going to show you how the sausage is made. And
are we pressing the button?
This is how the sausage is made. We've heard a lot about the summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un in the last few weeks, taking place in Singapore, as a moment that will be remembered for years to come in the timeline of international diplomacy. Coverage has focused much on North Korea and the issues associated with their nuclear program, their human rights record, and their relations with their powerful neighbor China. Coverage has equally focused on the United States and their new approach to global affairs in the wake of their exit from the Iran deal, as well as their currently frosty relations with the United Nations and the rest of the international community. However, not much focus has been placed upon the host nation, their human rights record, their political standpoint globally between these two powers, and exactly why they have positioned themselves as a mediator between these two nations. Most visitors to Singapore gain a very shallow understanding of what the country is. For many New Zealanders and visitors to this country, it is simply regarded as one of the best layovers in global travel. For those who take the time to leave the duty-free area of Changi Airport, it's a clean, orderly, chewing gum-free city with world-class shopping, top hotels, and an array of fun attractions to experience whilst awaiting further travel to Asia or the rest of the world. Most visitors enjoy what the country has to offer from a materialistic standpoint and don't ask any further questions. For safety reasons, they understand that Singapore has a harsh and unforgiving penal system, but don't probe further because, much like the owner of an iPhone or the customer of a petrol station, they don't want to know how the sausage is made when the individual derides so much pleasure in the ignorance of the reality. I was very much in the same situation. From 2005 to 2010, I was a resident of Singapore. My family was sponsored by a large multinational American corporation to live and work in Singapore on an expatriate package. I lived in a community of foreigners from all over the world, attended a British international school, was a member of an expatriate members club, and fully utilized all the benefits the country had to offer. However, Singaporean politics was never discussed unless the subject came to misdemeanors that might affect us directly. This was because the unspoken deal between us as expatriates and the government was that as long as we contributed to the nation's wealth and stayed out of the political sphere, we were allowed full access and control of the former colonial institutions that allowed foreigners to continue a lifestyle not dissimilar to that enjoyed by white people throughout the warmer non-white colonies back in the days of empire. A lifestyle of lavish houses, gin and tonics by the pool, and fine dining in exclusive members clubs was generally par for the course for expatriates in Singapore, and still is to this day. Personally, I hold no ill will towards Singapore. My childhood there was second to none, and I consider it a second home. But I also understand that my experience, much like those visiting, is a world away from that of the locals. So in light of recent events and a lack of coverage on the country itself, it seems fitting that today the illusion of Singapore should be burst. When talking about modern Singapore, though, we need to start with the death of a very important man.
To take ourselves within less than one generation from a developing country to one of the most developed countries in the world, you know, we have to be grateful for Mr. Lee Kuan Yew for having this far-sighted vision.
It will be prudent for us in East Asia to have Europe as a full partner.
To talk about Singapore's success is to talk about its first Prime Minister, Lee Kuan Yew. Adored by many, abhorred by some, LKY, as he is often referred to, was as controversial as he was visionary.
He does loom larger than life. A lot of the story Singapore tells itself is wrapped up with my grandfather, and a lot of the story the world has about Singapore is wrapped up with him.
Although he's a very rough and tough man, but he gives you that confidence that I get things done. You may not like it, never mind, but this is the way things should be happening.
When Lee died in 2015, an estimated 1.5 million Singaporeans turned up to say their final goodbyes. Most were ordinary people, grateful for what they said were the contributions of a great man.
That was an Al Jazeera report featuring two Singapore political leaders and Lee Kuan Yew's grandson. Lee Kuan Yew is seen by Singaporeans as the father of the nation, almost a Singaporean Nelson Mandela. He was a Cambridge-educated lawyer who led the first credible grassroots student movement against British colonial rule on a wave of Singaporean feelings of betrayal after the humiliation of the surrender to the Japanese in World War II. He worked with British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan on a plan for decolonization and a merger with Malaysia. He began as a fervent social democrat who saw a merger with Malaysia as critical to prevent a communist uprising in Singapore. The handover to Malaysia in 1963 was a success at first, but all that changed with the 1964 race riots. Singaporean descendants of Chinese settlers were scared by the indigenous Malay nationalism coming from the mainland, and after a Malay nationalist rally at the Padang, they rioted in response, killing 22 people and injuring 450. The riots meant Singapore was expelled from Malaysia in 1965, and Lee changed from a democratic leader to a soft authoritarian. After visibly weeping on television for the future of his country, here is Lee in 1965 outlining the Singapore dream that he would go on to achieve.
We are going to have a multiracial nation in Singapore. We will set the example. This is not a Malay nation, this is not a Chinese nation, this is not an Indian nation. Everybody will have his place. Equal. Language, culture, religion. And finally, let us really, Singaporeans, reunite. Regardless of race, language, religion.
To his credit, Lee achieved his goal. He made significant developments in the welfare state to give Singaporeans living conditions unparalleled in Southeast Asia, in the hope that Singaporeans would not riot again if they were healthy, housed, educated, and fed. He made sure state housing estates had racial quotas to prevent segregation and ghettos popping up. He made sure that each major religion had their most holy day observed as a public holiday and imposed stiff penalties on social ills like graffiti, drugs, and firearms. Corruption was ruthlessly purged, and the country was open to Western business, not only as a way to nationally appropriate Singapore's colonial identity as a hub of trade, but also to prevent communist infiltration from Chinese Singaporeans sympathetic to Mao. Most importantly, though, the anniversary of the riots is forever marked as Racial Harmony Day, where Singaporean schools read this pledge to religious tolerance. We, the people in Singapore, declare that religious harmony is vital for peace, progress and prosperity in our multiracial and multireligious nation. We resolve to strengthen religious harmony through mutual tolerance, confidence, respect and understanding. We shall always recognize the secular nature of our state, promote cohesion within our society, respect each other's freedom of religion, grow our common space whilst respecting our diversity, foster interreligious communications, and thereby ensure that religion will not be abused to create conflict and disharmony in Singapore. This is the Singapore that exists today, a former colonial backwater of opium, tropical disease, and third world peasantry that Lee turned into a modern metropolis. But this all came at a cost, as Human Rights Watch reports.
Singapore's restrictions on freedom of assembly are very draconian. Any cause-related gathering, no matter how small, requires a police permit, which is rarely ever granted.
The only place people are allowed to assemble somewhat freely is a very small section of a very small park in one place in Singapore. The case of Dolovan Wham is a perfect example of just how ridiculous these restrictions have become. He is facing criminal charges for organizing three peaceful events without getting police permits. A candlelight vigil outside a prison to support the family of a condemned man. A silent protest in a subway car with eight people. And an indoor conference where a foreigner called in by Skype without specific police authorization. The restrictions on public gatherings are part of a broader pattern of restricting critical speech in the country.
It's time for the Singapore government to recognize that critical speech and peaceful assembly are part of the democratic process, and to amend the laws that prevent people from speaking freely.
What's more, Singapore adapted the British Internal Security Act, which was originally meant to deal with communist spies and terrorist threats. It's now used to hold political prisoners indefinitely without trial if the individual poses a threat to religious or racial harmony. 36 men are currently imprisoned without trial under this act. And then there's the issue of press freedom. This is Lee Kuan Yew in 1988, speaking on the matter of press freedom in Singapore.
Singapore's domestic debate is a matter for Singaporeans. We allow American journalists in Singapore in order to report Singapore to their fellow countrymen. We allow their newspapers to sell in Singapore so that we can know what foreigners are reading about us. But we cannot allow them to assume a role in Singapore that the American media plays in America, that of invigilator, adversary, and inquisitor of the administration. If allowed to do so, they will radically change the nature of Singapore society, and I doubt if our social glue is strong enough to withstand such treatment.
This was said by Lee in 1988, but has been repeated by People Action Party leaders for the last 30 years. Singapore also maintains corporal punishment as a preventative measure for assault, rape, and vandalism, which consists of being beaten 3 times minimum by a rattan cane on the bare buttocks. They also still utilize capital punishment for murder, kidnapping, and for drug possession. For example, 500 grams of cannabis or more automatically warrants death by hanging. As for political opponents, the ruling PAP still use an old Lee Kuan Yew trick of bullying them into silence by bankrupting them through a slew of endless lawsuits. So what are Trump and Kim doing there? Why is Singapore opening its doors to both of them? Because Singapore is arguably the most non-aligned of the traditionally non-aligned states when it comes to foreign policy. Singapore has always walked the line between major superpowers as simply a place for transactions and nothing more. And a summit like this provides an inherent benefit for the island, because to be seen as a vassal for a larger power would, in the eyes of Singapore's leaders, risk a proxy conflict with Malaysia or Indonesia. Singapore is more than welcome to host, because that's where its strength as a nation lies, as a facilitator. But this meeting provides a conundrum for Singapore. How can it claim to be a country that champions racial harmony and religious freedom whilst hosting and welcoming two leaders who champion neither? And equally, the example of Singapore itself poses a very tough question for us here in New Zealand. Singapore is often regarded in different ways by both the left and the right wing in this country as an example to follow. Yet that example was founded upon the repression of political opponents, freedom of speech, and a free press. Therefore, philosophical questions must be asked, such as whether it's morally just to suspend the rights of citizens indefinitely and enforce a state of social justice and racial harmony, or whether a nation is truly harmonious if harmony must be rigidly enforced. There is no doubt that Lee Kuan Yew was a political genius in some regards, and that what he has achieved is incredible. But if in New Zealand we suspended our democracy, our freedom of speech, our freedom of assembly, and our right to protest, and in return we were given laws that enforced racial equality, social welfare, and national harmony, backed by rigid enforcement, would we take that deal? Or is it better to achieve those goals through a free and open society?
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.